Hello, welcome to this Sunshine School webinar. I'm Maggie Hard, and it's a pleasure to be invited to talk to you about doing Jung. I'm going to share my screen now and hope that we can look at some of these PowerPoints and this information and the material I'm going to show. So I'll be using various material during this session, especially my cartoon book on Jung. Now, this was published originally in 1992, and it's been reprinted and revised many times since. And here are a few of the various editions of it that might interest you. I'm drawing this to your attention because many of the illustrations that I'll be using today in this webinar are courtesy of the publishers from that book, cleverly done by the artist Michael McGuinness in various different formats. I think the latest publication is 2015, and it's to do with it's called Jung, A Graphic Guide. So let's make a start then on what's important about Jung and who he is. Who was Carl Jung? That's my first question. He was born in 1875 in Switzerland, and he trained as a medical doctor, and he specialized in psychiatry. And for several years, he worked in an asylum researching mental health and schizophrenia, especially with his word association studies. And here we have, word association studies in Freud and Jung and their work with schizophrenia. And in 1906, he began a friendship with Freud, but this ended acrimoniously in 1913. So Jung went on to develop his own ideas about the soul or the psyche, and he developed them into analytical psychology, distinct from Freud's psychoanalysis. And he established a C.G. Jung Institute, which is still going strong today, training many Jungian analysts around the world. Now, what interests us as astrologers is that Jung had a lifelong concern with the divide between science and religion, which he described in himself as his number one and his number two personalities. So, number one was scientific and ambitious, and it was conventional and seeking status and a civilized lifestyle. Whilst number two was timeless, close to God, nature, night, and dreams. As he said, it was like the breath of the great world of stars and endless space. Now, here he is sitting on his stone as number two, where he asked himself, am I the one sitting on the stone, or am I the stone on which he is sitting? So this is his number two personality, this connection with something mysterious and very cosmological. Now, I won't go into his own chart in detail right now, but we can readily see these two different personalities, number one, number two, science and mystic, science or diviner, whichever way you want to call it. But both of these are mirrored in his own chart. And we can see that in that he's got Aquarius rising, Saturn rising in Aquarius. That must be the number one, the scientist, the conventional person, the one who wants status, success, and so on. And on the other hand, look at we're talking about a Leo here. So his sun is in Leo and it's setting on that western angle. So and that must be about Jung as the diviner and the artist and this knowing of number two, something else. Now, as it was, Jung was very inspired by ancient wisdom traditions, especially both East and West, and especially mythology and magic and alchemy. And he developed Plato's understanding of what are called the ideas or the forms, the ordering principles, the ordering principles within all reality. And for us mortals, they manifest as what are called the archetypes, primal principles of the psyche. The archetypes are instincts. They're like the homing instinct in birds. And as such, they determine our actions. And yet they also regulate our very perception itself. So we see things certain ways. For example, the archetypes manifest as images, like the archetypal mother or father, the child, the eternal youth is an archetype, the wise old man you might have heard of, and so on, all of which appeared in the ancient gods in all cultures and all epochs. So here, for example, is Loki, right? He is the archetype of the trickster, and doesn't he look like a trickster? He's known to us, of course, as Mercury or Hermes, and he's from Icelandic mythology, but to us he's like the Mercury or Hermes trickster. And there was a key archetype for Jung, it was very important to him. It was the archetype of what he called the self. Always write it with a capital S. And this self has as its image the mandala or the circle. And the circle and the square is very important, the three and the four in numerology. Now, this image shows how we strive for wholeness and unity. It's about unity. And it's found especially in sacred texts and arts, evoking the unity of divine and human, world soul and human soul. But the interesting thing is that if the mandala, according to Jung, is the image of that unity, the image of unity is the mandala, then the experience of it is known through synchronicity. And synchronicity is about meaningful coincidence when world and psyche just click together in some mysterious, magical, and moving way. So the archetypes, according to Jung, underpin both a collective psyche and a personal psyche. And both collective and personal have a conscious and an unconscious dynamic. To Jung, this was also structured so that every part of consciousness was mirrored, or what he called compensated for, in the unconscious. So look at this, what he calls the structure of the psyche. This is the psyche or self and its energy, libido, is partly conscious and partly unconscious. So they've got two columns here, conscious and unconscious. And however, the two halves are compensatory to each other. So however one is, the other is the opposite. So a person is either extrovert or introvert, terms we're now very familiar with. And the psyche has four functions. These are the four functions of the psyche that we look at here. Four functions. And one of these is conscious, right? One is differentiated conscious, one is unconscious, and the other two are sort of standing on the sidelines. And here they are. They are thinking and feeling. They go together as a pair, conscious and unconscious, or an intuition, sensation, one might be conscious or unconscious. They're opposites, they're pairs. And briefly put, I can read this to you. Here we've got the two pairs of functions of the psyche. Sensation tells you something exists, thinking tells you what it is, feeling tells you whether it's good or not, and intuition tells you where it's coming from or where it's going. And these four types are archetypal, these four types color, if they color, they underpin four archetypal figures in the psyche. Now, I know this is difficult to hear all at once, but you will, this is basic Jungian understanding, and you can find it in any of the books you will read about Jung. But they are these four functions, they give rise to these archetypal figures. One pairing of archetypal figures is ego and shadow, and the other is persona and soul image, which you might have heard of more as anima and animus. So I'm going to look at this first one now, the ego and the shadow. So the ego and the shadow, is the ego is the light of consciousness, Jung says, and it's our purpose and our identity. It must be guarded and it gives moral consciousness. But light, any light casts a shadow, so others can be ethically suspect if your light is very bright. And how this works is that I think, you know, that I might be a kind, generous, feeling type, but that woman over there who I can't stand is very mean and uncaring, because thinking is opposite, of course, because feeling, which I am, caring, is opposite to thinking. And so Jung says that this actually operates not just in the personal psyche, that you might not like certain people and treat them as a shadow, but it actually works collectively with the whole of humanity. And his big example of that is that in the collective psyche, there was a collective ego and a collective shadow in the Nazi situation in Germany, which is, you know, very, this lovely picture by Michael illustrates that, I think. And secondly, to go back to our structure of the psyche, which we're going to leave in a minute, we've got the second two great archetypal images, the persona and the soul image, and this anima and animus. Now, again, these link with the four functions, right? And the persona, which I'm going to show you here, which is the conscious archetype here, the persona. The persona is the way, the face we wear for society. It's our mask. It's the way we are with each other people. And my persona, for example, may function through intuition. And so I may be artistic and impulsive, but it has its opposite. And the soul image will compensate unconsciously for this with intuition's opposite function, sensation. And yet, what is strange here is that it will be mysteriously attracted to that quality. So we tend to fall in love with this soul image. And it's called the anima in a man. And in a woman, it's called the animus. And it's the symbol of Eros. And the soul image has many different forms. And here we see, you know, the anima for a man can be light or dark, this feminine image, light or dark, virgin or whore, a source of wisdom, a muse, or she can be a femme fatale, luring him to his doom. So back to the structure of the psyche, and I don't expect you at all to grasp these nuances now, but you can check out any of the many primers on Jung, including my cartoon book, Introducing Jung. So how have astrologers made use of Jung? He died in 1961, before the New Age movement took root during the end of the 20th century. And he is credited with introducing Westerners to his analytical psychology and had a deep influence on New Age thinkers with his studies in occult philosophy, alchemy, magic, and astrology. And he combined that with psychology. And as a result, all divinatory forms during the end of that century, all divinatory forms, astrology, tarot, I Ching, whatever, they became imbibed with psychology and soul growth. And this allowed psychological astrology to develop. And instead of a birth chart, some astrologers created what became known as a map of the psyche. Well, incorporating Jungian psychology, astrology books taught how to delineate the map of the psyche from the birth chart. And Liz Green's work was the most prominent. And this attempt to map the psyche does continue today. Well, in my view, only in my view, this is a big misunderstanding, and it narrows Jung's vision. For Jung, the psyche is not limited to the subjective individual, but is also outside itself, in the world, outside oneself and in the world. And who could possibly, through symbol, consistently and objectively observe someone else's psyche? All this achieved was a correlation of astrological factors with Jung's structure of the psyche. However, there was little agreement on how Jung's terms matched up with astrological symbols. And for example, although this is a bit smudgy to read, I just point out to you that there is no agreement about matching the four elements with the four functions, which you think would be obvious. You've got four elements, right? Fire, earth, and water. You've got four functions. You could just match them up. But Dane Rudyard, Jeff Mayo, Liz Green, they all disagree on what that match is. There is no agreement either on the symbol for the soul image, the animus or anima. So Rudyard says it's Jupiter. Mayo has a whole list of four planets. Hamaker Zondag says it's the eighth house. And for Liz Green, anything and everything to do with relationships can be the soul image. And there is also no agreement even on the ego and shadow. So some say the ego is Saturn, some say it's the sun, some say it's the moon, Mercury, and the shadow, some people say is Pluto or Saturn or the 8th or 12th. Well, I am not going to go into more detail about how Jung's analytical psychology does or doesn't match with astrology, because this sort of correlation is just not the way to go. There is a better way in which Jung helps us as astrologers, especially with his understanding of divination. Firstly, then, let's look at this other way. He understood that many people, like diviners and psychoanalysts, have a symbolic attitude. And this means that whether a thing is a symbol or not depends on the consciousness of the one perceiving it. Now, if my car breaks down on the day I'm starting a new job, I may think this isn't a very good sign. So through divination with the I Ching, Jung knew that by seeing events symbolically, we can transform our understanding, just as the symbols in a dream can bring you a new insight. Now, this is far different to the map of the psyche. Let's look here at a little drawing which my partner Jeffrey Cornelius showed recently at the Company of Astrologers. Right, in this first little picture here, right, this first little picture here, this is a picture of the natural order of the cosmos. It's the tree of life. Let's say that's the tree of life. And look at its roots. It's rooted in the ground and it reaches up to the heavens where all the planets going through their planetary motions and the stars, the heavenly cosmos, they're all out there. This is the cosmic order, the natural order. And now in the second picture, who have we got here? We've got the little astrologer. We've got astrologers, us, coming along. There he is with a little chart in his hand, right? Here comes the astrologer. He's armed with his horoscope. Oh, I've got a horoscope. So at first he thinks the truth of the world and of other human beings can be seen objectively from a distant viewpoint. There he is standing there, separate from this person whose chart it is, who's connected to the cosmos. So this astrologer is going to cleverly tell us all objectively about this person and their psyche and how they're linked to cosmos. Well, at first, what picture three, you know, the more charts this astrologer does, the more he sees of symbols, the more he or she realizes that there is no separation of meaning, subject and object, and that astrologer and inquirer are together in the tree of life. So this is the two of them with the chart, there's the roots, there's the tree, there's the cosmos. They're all in the same thing, right? So they are intertwined. And we call this at the Company of Astrologers symbolic participation. The astrologer's psyche is not separate from the world or the client. And Jung has a fantastic illustration of this when he tells us about the following incident. And I love this incident from Jung. It's wonderful. So I'm going to read it to you. He says, I walk with a woman patient in a wood. She tells me that about the first dream in her life that had made an everlasting impression upon her. She had seen a spectral fox, a ghost fox, coming down the stairs in her parental home. At this moment, a real fox comes out of the trees, not 40 yards away, and walks quietly on the path ahead of us for several moments. The animal behaves as if it were a partner in a human situation. One fact is no fact, but when you have seen many, you begin to sit up, says Jung, and Jung has seen many such strange facts occurring around him. So what he's saying here is that both analyst and patient are in something together, but that something is not a projection by either or both of them. That something is bound up with them, but it is also independent of them. And the implications of this for the practice of psychoanalysis, analytical psychology, and any form of divination, including astrology, are enormous. This explicitly reveals, through synchronicity, that psyche is not confined to the mind or body of the person, but belongs to what Jung calls the collective unconscious, a level of reality that is non-personal yet is mysteriously intertwined with the personal. As with the fox, it manifests itself, therefore, not only in human beings, but also at the same time in animals and even in physical circumstances. So a key teaching to astrologers from Jung is what is called the secret mutual connivance, realizing that we are not standing outside of the situation, looking in objectively. So how does this affect us as sun sign astrologers, I ask you? Well, when we write sun sign columns, we don't encourage the reader to see the symbols as some sort of predetermined fate. Of course, we need to show some insight into psychoanalytic thought, but we don't try to map the psyche. Above all, we can use the symbol to activate the sun sign reader's imagination. And as the ancient astrologers said, through symbol, raise the mind to a higher level. There's a wonderful medieval woodcut which shows this. So everyone here in this woodcut, the astrologers, general people, are looking up to the cosmos with the earth in the middle, the zodiac going round, the celestial sphere, and everyone looks up and the inscription around it, which is in Latin, I won't read the Latin to you, but I'll read the translation. The translation is, under the power of the symbol, the soul or spirit settles itself, finds a home at a higher level than the ordinary world. The power of the symbol allows the soul to settle at a higher level than the ordinary world. Well, implications for astrology. Something happened in 2009, a remarkable development that is crucial for our sun sign astrology. And this is where we really do have to sit up. So Jung's Red Book was published, revealing to what extent Jung was steeped in esoteric and occult magical thinking. So what is Jung's Red Book, right? I'll try to explain and show why it is that understanding the Red Book will guide you as an astrologer. So after his split with Freud, Jung underwent a psychological crisis and embarked on an exploration of his own unconscious. He wrote down his inspirations and his fantasies and dreams and visions in notebooks known as the Black Books. And drawing on these records between 1913 and 1930, he embarked on an exquisitely illustrated volume telling of his profound encounters with the number two world. This is the Liber Novus, known as the Red Book, which he did not want to be made public before his death. It has stunning, colourful images drawn by Jung to illustrate his text. So do go online to look at them or look at the Red Book yourself. I can't show them to you for copyright reasons. However, the appearance of the Red Book created huge excitement in Jungian circles, revising our understanding of his work, and it especially leads to a revision of astrology. In brief, Jung's struggle between his number one and number two personalities, the scientist and the diviner, are played out again in what he calls two different truths, the scientific spirit of this time and the spirit of the depths. Now, the spirit of this time that we're in demands reasons and explanations, and humanity no longer has any gods. And in contrast, the spirit of the depths is activated by symbol and speaks through prophecy, but it's associated with a chaotic universe of chance and contradiction, and it's inexplicable and paradoxical. It's identified with Abraxas, the god of toads and magic, and is a reminder, like his number two personality, that the truth of this spirit is oriented to the stars and endless space. Now, what happens in the Red Book? Well, in the Red Book, Jung embarks on a fantasy journey to save his soul, wounded by struggling with these two different spirits, the spirit of this time and the spirit of the depths. He's just weary. And during his travels to save his soul, he meets with the giant sun god Izdubar. He is also known in Mesopotamian mythology as Gilgamesh, and there was some muddle with the name at one point in the translation. So Izdubar is very much Gilgamesh, a sun god. And this sun god, Izdubar, is on his way to set in the west. Now, Jung tells him he won't be able to sit there anymore because the scientific truth about the cosmos now is that the Earth revolves around the sun. It's no longer true that the sun goes around the Earth. So if the Earth turns and the sun does not sit, there is no Western land for Istibar, no place for the sun god to set or to rise again in the modern cosmos. Well, this news is poisonous and deadly to Istibar, right? And Jung has to explain it to him. It makes Istibar ill. But Jung says we had to swallow the poison of science, otherwise we would have met the same fate as you have. We'd be completely lamed if we encountered it unsuspecting and unprepared. But Istibar is very puzzled that the truth should be deadly, because the truth, he says, spoken by our astrologers and priests, is never poisonous. Well, Jung says there are two truths, one from science derived from outer things, and the other from priests, the keepers of the inner things. Astrologers are not only identified with priests, but the truth they speak comes from the spirit of the depths. Now, this shows the vital role of astrology for Jung. Istibar is not just a god, he is a sun god, and the sun is at the heart of the creation of the zodiac. Jung has found a simple yet profound image to condense the difference between abstract scientific truth, the earth revolving around the sun, and truth that we see with our own eyes every day, the sun rising and the sun setting. So the vital importance for astrologers of this exchange between Jung and Istibar has been pointed out by the astrologer and Jungian scholar Ryuji Kagami, and he says, for us astrologers, it shows clearly the clash of the pre-modern worldview with the rise of modern science. The pre-modern worldview, the world of Istibar, Gilgamesh, our cosmology out of which astrology is coming. Well, in modernity, Istibar can no longer set and then be reborn at sunrise. The gods are dying, so Jung thinks. But then Jung has a brilliant idea. He moves into an imaginal realm. He persuades Istibar that he can exist in the West as a fantasy. Istibar is turned into an egg because he's a fantasy, it can be anything. So let's make him an egg. And Jung carries the egg to the West, where Istibar is reborn as a fantasy and exists in imagination. This is deeply relevant to astrologers and to sun sign astrologers like us, especially the carriers of sun signs in the Western world. They are like Istibar, these astrologers, traveling to the Western setting. But in the scientific spirit of this time, the ancient cosmic imagination of Istibar can only exist as a fantasy. But is this not what we as sun sign astrologers do? We keep fantasy, the imaginal cosmos, alive in the West by evoking the circle of sun signs. The zodiac mandala portrays the unity of all things, but we experience that unity in synchronicity. Sun sign astrologers keep Istibar's spirit of the depths alive in the West by writing their sun sign columns. Pure fantasy. Most of Western culture in the spirit of this time rejects sun signs, dismissing them as nothing but fantasy. Astrologers are generally still thought to be bonkers, but even some astrologers reject sun sign columns thinking that there's a so-called real chart, right? But I would argue that by writing your sun sign columns, by keeping the zodiac images alive, you are enabling your readers to turn the image of the zodiac mandala into a lived experience of synchronicity, a sense of being meaningfully connected with the cosmos, world, and psyche united. Now, a reader will know whether or not the symbolic cap fits and whether or not he or she should wear it. So he or she might think, wow, imagine that. It says in my sun sign column today, it says that as a Taurus, I'll hear about a new baby today. And my daughter has just phoned to say she's pregnant. Well, are you a clever astrologer to predict an objective truth? No. Are you a gullible punter who finds everything credible? No. Are you walking with the fox and sitting up? Well, maybe. Creating a space through symbol that allows your reader a synchronistic experience often generates a rebirth, a new dawn when Izdebar can rise again. So finally, in the Red Book, right, Jung turns to the astrological image of the zodiac. We've got some lovely images here of the zodiac through the centuries, but Jung picks up the astrological image of the zodiac. And he says this extraordinarily wonderful thing. He says, the task is to give birth to the old in a new time. The soul of humanity is like the great wheel of the zodiac that rolls along the way. Everything that comes up in a constant movement from below to the heights was already there. There is no part of the wheel that does not come round again. But each time part of the wheel comes round again is unique. Because as Jung explains, and do listen carefully to how he explains this, he explains that the meaning does not lie in the eternal recurrence of the same old thing turning around all the time. The meaning does not lie in the eternal recurrence of the same, but in the manner of its recurring creation at any given time. So we recreate here. We, sometimes astrologers, are recreating the meaning of the zodiac as it turns for our age and our time. So when we look at a horoscope of whoever or whatever, we recreate its symbolism anew. And Jung reminds us that we don't have an objectified map of the psyche, but a secret mutual connivance between astrologer, world, client. And I'll sure remind you of Jeffrey's drawing again, the cosmos, the world, the astrologer, the client. We all roll around together. We might say of astrology, as Jung said of magic once, he said that magic makes what is not understood understandable in an incomprehensible manner. What is not understood understandable in an incomprehensible manner. And we are so lucky and privileged to be able to do that with sun signs. And to have Jung, I'll put his last chart up again, to have Jung born with his sun setting on that western horizon, bringing us this sun, this solar symbolism, the symbolic, bringing this and keeping this ancient cosmic idea of the sun alive in the west. So, oh, thank you for listening. Thank you so much for listening. And good luck with your sun sign journey, both east and west. Thank you. Bye for now.